Okay, so I just want to finish off a few things I was talking about the last day. We have seen cells appear to violate thermodynamics in that we get concentrations of things necessarily in certain parts of the cell and depleted in other parts of the cell. The examples I've given are motor proteins accumulating parts of the cell, could be on a kinesin motor that moves out to the plus ends of microtubules, or the acidification of lysosomes. So we've seen that this requires energy. It's a decrease in entropy for this to occur, and that's paid for by the energy of ATP hydrolysis. But we can do a little bit better than just this sort of hand-wavy qualitative view of these things. We can actually give a quantitative picture of how much energy is actually required. And this is using very elementary thermodynamics, and this equation for the free energy compared to what it is for the standard free energy. If you remember, the standard free energy is the free energy when you have 1 mole of reactants and 1 mole of products. When you don't have 1 mole of reactants and 1 mole of products, you're doing a real reaction, then that's modified by this term, this RT log N, the products over the reactants. So it turns out to be particularly simple in the case of the lysosome, and we have the figures. If we think of this as a reaction where we end up with 10 to the minus 5 inside a larger concentration and started with 10 to the minus 4 on the outside. It isn't really a reaction, but these laws are universal. So in this case, we can start to plug the numbers in. It's the afterwards, it's the amount that's inside. The reaction beforehand was the amount that was outside. We also know that the free energy change is equal to the equilibrium constant for this reaction. Now, of course, if this were allowed to go to equilibrium, we would have equal numbers inside and outside. The fact is, it isn't at equilibrium. You know the reason it isn't equilibrium is that ATP energy is expended in getting this unbalanced situation. So essentially, at equilibrium, this is going to be equal to zero because we've got HH. Those are going to cancel out. They're going to be equal concentration. The log of one is zero. So this term essentially cancels out. And we're left with the free energy change here. Is equal to RT log N inside and outside 10 to the minus 5 over 10 to the minus 7, which is 10 to the 2. So two things to take out of this. Firstly, that the answer is positive. Okay, it's going to be a positive number. That means energy has to be put in. So anytime you work out any parameter, when you work out a figure, you've got to test it against your common sense. And your common sense suggests that to get this situation to go away for equilibrium, you have to put energy in. But the second thing is it tells us we can work out in terms of, you know, how many ATP molecules that actually would require to do to achieve that situation, because we've now quantitated it. So how we pay for that overall in the reaction, though, because it's a positive just to do that on its own, how we pay for it is the larger negative hydrolysis of ATP, which overall still has a negative free energy change, and that's what drives this reaction. So we're going to be come on to talk about these and show you examples of this later, how this is actually done in terms of atoms and molecules. Now, ATP is going to come up. It's going to be a theme of molecular machines, a machine that does work. It has to have fuel. And by and large, that fuel is ATP, or if it isn't ATP, there's ATP in there somewhere driving, for instance, a concentration change to make a concentration gradient, which can be used to drive various processes. But there's this misconception that people can pick up from the literature this term that ATP bond is high energy. It isn't that, you know, this ATP molecule is sort of crackling with lightning, storing sort of energy. All it means is that this bond is readily hydrolyzable, and it gives out a lot of energy when it does that. But even that doesn't particularly make ATP special. You know, there's sort of also a misconception that, you know, evolution has chosen the very best molecule to do a certain task. This shows the free energy of various biological molecules. These are chemistries that go on inside cells. And we find, ATP hydrolysis shown here at about minus 30 kilojoules per mole. But these are ordered. And look at one that we're going to talk about today, a reaction. This reaction actually is the first, the energy from this is actually used to make the first ATP molecule that's created in glycolysis. And it's actually got a higher free energy, and for phosphoenolpyruvate, also in glycolysis, it's almost twice as much. So I'm going to argue that there isn't really anything particularly important about the reaction of ATP. One of the reasons why ATP is probably being chosen, though chosen is the wrong word, is that it's a molecule that probably comes from the RNA world before proteins are actually involved, and sort of was there sort of from the start. Maybe the first proteins sort of bound this, and so we've got kind of caught into using ATP. But I'll argue that there's nothing particularly special about it, and that's for the following reason. What's most important in cells is not that ATP has a large energy of hydrolysis, but that the ATP reaction is the reaction for hydrolysis is kept very far from equilibrium. In cells, if ATP was at equilibrium, and the only time ATP in your body will be in equilibrium is when you're dead, okay, because you won't be making any more. You won't have this high throughput steady state. If it's allowed to go to equilibrium, the amount of ATP compared to ADP would be only 1%, because the reaction lies very far in this direction towards hydrolysis. But what the cell does is that it holds this reaction very far from equilibrium. In fact, the concentration of ATP is almost 10 times that of ADP. And it does that, as we'll see in the fourth lecture in this series, where I'll show you how ATP is made within cells. But it keeps making ATP at a very large rate to hold this reaction very much in this direction, which essentially means that it's poised, ready to go in this direction very precipitously, okay, because there is so much ATP there. And again, if we use this reaction and we pump in these numbers, because there's a large amount of ATP in the bottom, this makes this less than 1, which makes the log less than 1, which makes the overall free energy more negative than it would otherwise be. So at equilibrium, we showed that the delta G naught was about minus 30 kilojoules per mole. But on top of that, when you plug in these numbers, because it's kept so far from equilibrium, it becomes minus 52 kilojoules per mole. So you could even imagine, say, an organism that is discovered on Mars, right? And it turns out to have a completely different biochemistry than has evolved on Earth. The delta G naught might actually be positive as long as you hold the equilibrium, you hold the reactants very far away from equilibrium. Then you could still get enough negative free energy to drive the processes in this putative Martian organism. So anytime you read in textbooks about ATP being high energy, or thinking, you know, there's something particularly special about ATP, you know, it's the most energy-packed molecule you could possibly imagine, it's not true. Okay. So what I'd like to do today is to now talk in molecular machines about enzymes. And as I said at the start, I'm taking as simple an enzyme as I can possibly think of to make some of the points that we're going to make in more complicated machines. So I'm building up an argument here that's going to go over a number of lectures. So the outline of what we're going to talk about today is I'm going to talk about enzymes as molecular jigs, and I'll have to, there's two meanings of that word, of course, and I'll explain the one I mean. I'm going to look at this simple example, phosphoglycerate kinase, which catalyzes that reaction I pointed out that actually has a higher free energy change, standard free energy change, than ATP, and actually is used to make the first ATP molecule in glycolysis. I'm going to look a bit at its mechanism, and then how structural data tells us, gives us more insight into that mechanism. And then finally, to loop back to what I was talking about in the very first lecture, about the different, what makes chemistry in real cells different than that in solution, I'm going to talk about some surprises about how PGK works in cells. Okay, so what do I mean by a jig? I don't mean dancing around. Of course, molecules would be appropriate because they have thermal energy. They're not at absolute zero. They are executing Brownian motion at all times. What I'm talking about is a jig in an engineering sense. And a jig is something that allows you to work on a component. It allows you to align things much more carefully, okay, when you're sort of holding them. Reduces the amount of energy you have to put in to bring things together because they're sort of they're held in position. It stops them, getting spoiled. It protects the components. It stops them getting spoiled by, you know, as you start to paint things, for example, or getting dirty or lost sort of on the floor. And also, when you've used them, the energy you expended putting things into the jig, raising it off the floor, for example, you get back once you take it off. And the jig itself is reusable, can be reused over and over again to make many more of the same components. And we'll see these ideas come up as an analogy for how things work at the molecular level with enzymes. So we'll see that they align the chemicals involved, the reactants, to make them easier to work on. They protect the components, and in this case, we'll see they protect them from an unwanted hydrolysis. We'll see that the enzymes or catalysts, they themselves do not consume energy and are unchanged at the end of the process. And for that reason, they can be reused. So again, the definition of a catalyst, they can be reused again and again after the process is completed. So what I want to now talk about is phosphoglycerate kinase as an example. And this is a particularly simple reaction, which I'll show you just here. So this shows glycolysis, and it's this part that we're interested in, how we make the very first molecule of ATP. The reaction involves 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate. these are names, but I'll show you can break them down to give understanding. And it makes 3-phosphoglyceric acid, or in the ionized form, 3-phosphoglycerate. And you'll see there's 2 phosphates here, only 1 phosphate here. The phosphate is transferred to ADP to make ATP. So let's just break down the chemistry of that for the moment. Okay, so we have 1,3, in this case, bis, that means 2-phosphoglycerate. Now the glycerate comes from glycerol, okay? Glycerate tells you that one of the OH groups has been oxidized to a carboxylate group. And that's shown here. This is the carboxylate group, but it's forming an ester in the 3 position with a phosphate. Now, these, of course, it's wrong to say they're not stable because they're actually forming a bond. But if this were hydrolyzed, that gives out an awful lot of energy. Okay, it's more stable to have this phosphate removed into solution. Of course, it will have larger entropy as it's released into solution, but also there's a large amount of enthalpy, heat, given out when that occurs. So it's 3-phosphoglycerate. This is an OH from glycerol, as it would be in glycerol. This would be an OH in glycerol, but it's got a phosphate group on it, and that's the 1-phosphate group. This makes 3-phosphoglycerate, or 3-phosphoglyceric acid. So we still have our phosphate here, but this phosphate has been removed, and it has been removed because ATP comes along and takes off the phosphate. So we can think of ADP as AMP, adenosine monophosphate with a phosphate group. This phosphate group attacks the red phosphate, removes it. This makes AMP, ADP, ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and this phosphate has been transferred to ATP. So that's the reaction. And now I'd like to talk about the mechanism by which this occurs. And how, in the absence of crystal structures, what can we tell that's going on at the molecular level? So the argument I'm going to make here is that the enzyme has 2 binding sites for each of the substrates. That's not necessarily the only way it could work. Okay, we're going to suggest that the phosphate is transferred between the 2 substrates when they are bound on the enzyme. Another way it could happen would be that the bisphosphoglyceric acid comes along and it leaves a phosphate covalently bound to the enzyme, and then the ATP comes along, ADP comes along and picks up that phosphate to form ATP. But with even not knowing the crystal structures, we can work out that that is not the case. And the argument is as follows. So to show you what the argument is that we imagine that we can get random binding of any of the substrates. For instance, the 1,3-phosphoglyceric acid could bind first, or the other substrate could bind first. So this could be entirely random. Then the other substrate could bind to its site. So first case, if we had 1,3-phosphoglyceric acid, the ADP could bind. If we had the ADP bind first, then the second substrate binds second. Then we're suggesting on the enzyme, we're getting direct transfer of the phosphate to form the products. And then either one of those can leave randomly and then the next one will leave, and we end up again with our generated free enzyme ready to bind randomly any one of the substrates. So how do we know that that might be true, or how can we rule out the other mechanism that there's only one binding site? Well, it's actually quite simple. what you do is look at the reaction in the presence of a high concentration of one of the other substrates. Okay. If there's only one binding site and you have saturated that with one of the substrates, then essentially that's going to give a few binding sites for the second substrate to come in. And so the first substrate will actually compete against the second, and the enzyme rate will be very low. On the other hand, if there are two independent sites, and this one is essentially saturated, so all the enzyme has an ADP, then as you vary the other substrate, 1,3-phosphoglyceric acid, is essentially this will behave like an enzyme with one site, which has almost covalently bound to it, the ADP, because it's present at such high concentration. And what you will get is the normal kinetics that you would expect for a single site enzyme. That's, in effect, when you do the experiment, what happens. And you can prove the experiment doing it the other way around, is that you can then have a high concentration of 1,3-phosphoglyceric acid in here, and you can vary the concentration of ADP and then see, do you get a hyperbolic curve? So this rules out the fact that there would only be one site. It's consistent, but does not prove that there are two sites. So what I'm going to argue here is that these enzymes have all the properties of these jigs that are used in engineering. And firstly, they align things to make them easier to work on. So how do we know that this reaction occurs in a very specific way, a way that absolutely depends on the stereochemistry, how things are bound, and how the two substrates are aligned with each other? There, from organic chemistry, there are well-known reactions between phosphate groups where the one group is attacked by the other, and a so-called in-line attack, that the direction of attack is along the direction of the bond that is actually broken. Now, if this occurs, it goes through a transition state in which these oxygens are actually inverted in configuration. Okay, so it's like an umbrella facing this way, and then it becomes inverted going in the opposite direction. So if it's an inline attack, then that is a direct consequence of what will happen to those phosphate oxygens. So if we have this inline attack, we go through this transition state just like there, and then as the bond is broken, which will be this bond here, then we have an inversion of the configuration. So if I go back to the start, so we start out like that, we're being attacked by ADP from the right. We go through this transition state, and there's this inversion of configuration. Now, by methods I won't go into, but just to point out how it's done, of course, all those oxygens are equivalent oxygens, and the phosphate group isn't optically active. So to prove this, you have to use some clever chemistry where you use different isotopes of oxygen, and indeed you can replace one of the oxygens by a sulfur group. So all of these oxygens have completely different chemical properties, and you can use various resonance techniques to show that there actually is a reversal of configuration. So this is consistent with the idea that that attack is directly in line with the bond that is broken. Therefore, the enzyme has to align the ADP with respect to the substrate such that you get a very precise attack. As an aside, this rules out the other possibility that the 1,3-phosphoglyceric acid actually was attacked by the protein to leave a covalently bound group, and then the ADP comes along and then picks it up. In that case, there would be a reversal of the configuration of the phosphate when it was attacked by the enzyme, and then a reversal again by the ADP when it attacked. So if you have a reversal and then a reversal back again, you would end up with the configuration you started with. So this experiment showing inversion of configuration is not consistent with having only one binding site on the enzyme. So the design for our enzyme is that it should align the components precisely, and we've shown that it needs to do that by these experiments. But what we also have to show is that it will reduce the activation energy, because going through that intermediate where the phosphates are all in a plane, these are negatively charged groups and they come closer together. So that means going much higher in energy. And that's one of the reasons why ATP is stable in solution. You know, it'll give a high energy of hydrolysis, but why doesn't it get hydrolyzed all the time? The reason is, for kinetic reasons, the size of this uphill bump that you have to go doesn't change the overall thermodynamics of before and after state of the free energy, but it does change the kinetics. It changes how many molecules are going to have enough energy to surmount this barrier. And at normal thermal energies, very few molecules do. But to overcome that, you have to be able to do that on an enzyme, and to do it quickly, you have to reduce that activation energy. And we want to see how the protein actually does that. And the next thing is this 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate is very susceptible to hydrolysis from water. Okay, remember, water is present at over 50 molar. So how do we protect the loss of this to just producing heat and inorganic phosphate, whereas what we really want to do is to capture the energy of that bond in ATP? So these are things that we require of our design. So we've seen things have to be aligned precisely. We've seen that this activation state, where the negative charges are all in one plane now and much closer together than they were in their tetrahedral conformation before this attack. And we've also seen that as well as ATP attacking, that could just as well be replaced by a water molecule. And insofar as the enzyme is going to make it easier for the ADP to attack, it could also make it easier for the water molecule to attack. And the water molecules are present at much higher concentration. So how do you avoid that happening? So what I want to change now to is some structural data, which tells us a lot about how the enzyme manages to do this. So this shows the crystal structure of phosphoglyceric acid. It was solved quite a long time ago in the 1960s, but it immediately created a conundrum about how this could work. Nicely, it showed where the substrates bind, and the molecule has two lobes, okay, and the substrates bind in one or the other of the lobes. But the problem is that they are much too far apart to actually react with each other. And so this immediately suggested that there should be perhaps some conformational change was triggered when you have both substrates there that would bring them very, very close together, such that then the reaction could occur. That was more easily said than done, because it took over 30 years for people to manage to get crystal structure of a closed form, and I'll show that here. So look at the difference. This is the substrates before. The phosphoglyceric acid would be here. And afterwards, there is a conformational change which brings the substrates close together. We can see the ATP there, and the phosphoglyceric acid is a little bit hidden, and there is a magnesium ion between them. So let's look at what occurs at the active site when things are brought close together. So this is our ADP molecule here. This is the 3-phosphoglyceric acid, and we've modeled here a phosphate group as it would be bound in the 1,3-phosphoglyceric acid, or as it would be bound in ATP. So this is like, in the model, a phosphate group that's in transition from here onto the ATP. We can see that the ATP is attacking directly along the line of the bond that's broken. And we can see that there is a magnesium ion here with its 2+ charges, a lysine, and arginines, which are also plus charged. So in this transition state, where these negative charges are going to become closer together as it forms a plane, the enzyme provides countercharges from the lysine and the arginine that stabilizes that and therefore reduces its energy. Now let's look at what happens. This is the transition state when the two domains have come together. Let's look at what it was like beforehand. So this lysine here, which comes from the C-terminal domain, it was far away from the site, but afterwards it moves close to stabilize that energy. So now we may begin to understand why this protects from 55 molar water. To get the conformation to occur, you need to have both substrates there. If you only had the 3-phosphoglyceric acid, then the water molecule doesn't trigger the conformational change, right? It doesn't bring in the lysine, and therefore, in the case of the water, it doesn't stabilize the transition state. So it still has that large energy bump to get over, whereas when you have the right substrates there, then the whole thing works. So that's before and that's after. So this is our conformational change that's occurring. That's the transition state. That's higher energy, that these are much closer to each other than they were when they had a tetrahedral configuration. And it's the coming in of this lysine and arginine with the conformational change that stabilizes that transition state. So that's how we avoid hydrolysis, because the water molecule does not have the binding energy, doesn't make the specific contacts that the ADP makes to trigger that change. So we've seen how it's aligned, we've seen how we've reduced the activation energy, and we've seen how we protect from water. And it's only with this 32 degree conformational change that the reaction is actually triggered. So what I want to now go back to is this idea of energy. And this reaction has a free energy change of minus 18 kilojoules per mole. That's even though it has to make ATP, where you have to put in 30 kilojoules per mole plus 32 kilojoules per mole to make ATP. It still is in this direction, so the reaction goes far in this direction. But the question we want to ask is, where is the energy released okay, to the ATP. And you would think that the energy is transferred when the phosphate is actually moved across from the 1,3-bisphosphoglycerate to make the ATP on the enzyme here. But a very strange thing comes when you actually look at the equilibrium on the enzyme. So be sure what I'm talking about here is enzyme bound substrates, okay? And on the enzyme, and methods I won't go into, you can work out how much ATP is bound on the enzyme and how much ADP is bound on the enzyme. You would think because the energy change is minus 18 kilojoules per mole, that it would lie very much in this direction. But actually, when you do the experiment, you find that these are almost one-to-one bound to the enzyme. So the free energy change on the enzyme is almost zero, okay, because the equilibrium is one. So this doesn't really make sense what's actually going on. But if you actually look at this diagram, you'll find that it actually does make sense. You'll see that the energy changes here are rather small, okay, between the enzyme substrate and the enzyme product. And the large energy change is occurring when the products are actually released from the enzyme. So the point about this and why the reason is that the substrates that are bound to the enzyme are actually stabilized at all times by the positive charges that are there. And there's really only one bond broken and one bond made when you are doing the reaction, okay? So actually bound on the enzyme, there's not a large change in the energy. So because we got this stabilization and we have all that negative charge there, but when the conformational change occurs backwards to release the products, then you no longer have these positive charges being able to stabilize. You have a lot of negative charge all together in a very confined space. And the energy is released when the products are actually released into solution. So the enzyme stabilizes the start, the end, and the transition. Everything is very stabilized when you're bound to the enzyme. The energy is actually released and the conformational change occurs when you release the products into solution. So it's the release of products that is actually the rate limiting step, and that's the step at which the energy is actually released. So we will see that as we release the products, we go back to the starting state. We have this 32 degree rotation in the opposite direction, which is releasing the products. When we look at the next lecture, which is on motor proteins, showing this is actin and this is a myosin protein, a motor protein that moves along, that the products are bound in a very stable state, but it's only when they bind to actin and are released that we then get a conformational change. But in that case, the conformational change is used to move along the cytoskeletal track. So we'll find this theme come up again and again in these molecular machines. So finally, I'd now like to talk about PGK in cells. Okay, so what I've talked about at the moment has all been derived from solution studies, dilute solutions of the enzyme. And I want to go back just to make a connection from what I was talking about in the first lecture. So we've seen that cells are very crowded and there's limited diffusion, and particularly for enzymes to be able to diffuse, it has to get through this very packed environment. So in that case, why doesn't this 1,3-phosphoglyceric acid, which we've shown is very readily hydrolyzable in this 55 molar water, why doesn't it get hydrolyzed before it even finds a PGK molecule? And it was a curious experiment that suggested that there was something interesting going on. You can measure the rate of the reaction of PGK going in this backwards direction. Okay, enzymes catalyze the forward and the backward reaction to equal extents, so it's just as valid to measure the back reaction. And this is a rather tedious discontinuous assay, and it tells you that the rate of turnover is about one molecule per second per kinase molecule. But there's a much cleverer continuous reaction you can do, and that uses the fact that the back reaction is going this way, and the enzyme that comes after it is glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate dehydrogenase, known as GAPDH, and it has the usual property that one of its substrates has a good spectrophotometric signal. You can measure it has a strong signal at 340 nanometers, and these lend themselves very well to so-called coupled assays. So you couple the first reaction to one that has a reaction where there's something that you can measure spectrophotometrically. And so in this case, you would measure just the reduction, the decrease in the signal at 340 nanometers for NADH. And that works out to be, and you do it, it works out to give you a reaction that appears to be 500 times faster. You get a rate of, so this same enzyme appears to be working at 500 molecules per second per kinase molecule. And this led to the idea that there might be associations between glycolytic enzymes, that they aren't all reacting just floating around in solution. Indeed, there are some ideas that some of these glycolytics are actually bound in clusters on actin filaments. But why you get a faster reaction when you're using the enzyme afterwards could be that the substrate is actually passed in the complex between one enzyme and the next. And this direct association may explain the very high rates. A second piece of evidence about particularly these glycolytic enzymes is that compared to many enzymes, they're present at very high concentrations. So that's 0.13 millimolar, and that's 1.4 millimolar. Those are really very high concentrations. And it could be that if you compare them, they're actually at higher concentrations than their substrates. Okay. And it could be that at these high concentrations, these enzymes start to form complexes with each other. And it could mean that also because the enzymes are a higher concentration than their substrates, that all the substrate might be enzyme bound, and that they form complexes, and that the substrates never actually see solution. They're sort of passed along in this almost sort of solid state between these solid state enzymes. So the summary of what we've seen today is that they are molecular jigs that align and facilitate, and they are reusable. The conformation only trips a reaction when both substrates are bound, and we've seen how that avoids hydrolysis. The energy releasing step is the release from products, not the reaction on the enzyme. and that these things may be forming intermediates that may never freely diffuse. So the next day I'm going to be taking these ideas and showing how they allow us to understand how motor proteins work.